Thus says the Eternal, where is the bill of your mother's divorcement? Now, you know, people that want to try to get Bible justification for divorce say, well, you know, God had a bill of divorcement. That's mentioned twice in the whole Bible. So be careful what you grasp at to try to justify human reasoning. What was the bill of divorcement God wrote against Israel? Has God married somebody else since he divorced Israel? No. No, all he did was put her away. He didn't remarry. Well, did he have the right to refuse to live with her because of her harlotry? But he didn't have a right to remarry. You know, he's going to take the same wife back. In fact, in the book of Revelation, when the bride comes, it says his wife has made herself ready. Same one he's married to all along. 12 tribes. The people wanted to have a Bible excuse for divorce, so they jumped and said, why, the Bible all the way through talks about how God put away Israel for divorce. Therefore, it's all right to put away somebody if they're immoral. Well, you better be sure you're not getting that out of the Bible. Now, let's read on and see what he's talking about here. Where is the bill of your mother's divorcement, whom I have put away? And you know, one of the conditions of that bill of divorcement was, if you found a fault in somebody that allowed you to put them away during the time of that bill of divorcement, you never could take them back. But what does Paul say in 1 Corinthians 7? Or let him be reconciled to his wife. That's what he said. So that showed he discounted that bill of divorcement. He said, be reconciled to your wife. Well, you couldn't do that under the bill of divorcement. If you use the bill of divorcement, you couldn't be reconciled to your wife. Well, let's read on here anyway. Where is the bill of your mother's divorcement, whom I have divorced or put away? Or which of my creditors is it to whom I sold you? Behold, for your iniquities, you sold yourselves. Now, you see, we can't blame God for what's going to happen to us. God just warns us what's going to happen to us, and right away we say, well, he's causing it. No, he's not either. You know, but there's a great lesson there. Anytime you reveal prophecy, you're going to be blamed for it happening. I mean, you may not have one thing to do with it happening. Where can any of us prophesy something and then make it happen? And yet, you know, people always through the Bible were held as if they made it happen. Yeah, you're the guy that said that. You must have been in on that. You must have somehow brought that to pass. You made it happen to us. Well, that isn't true. Prophecy is something God foresaw that we were going to bring on ourselves. Now, you read that and notice. For your iniquities, you have sold yourselves. Don't blame me. I didn't sell you. If you say, I sold you, where are my creditors I sold you to? So that's what he's saying here. No, no, you sold yourselves. You sold yourselves for your sins and by your way of life. But you want to blame it on me. Behold, for your iniquities you sold yourselves, and for your transgressions your mother is put away. Now, wait a minute. For your transgressions is your mother put away. Well, that's not what everybody said. Everybody said the mother was put away for her transgressions. For your transgressions is your mother put away. Well, I wonder what that's all about. Well, you better be careful, you know, how you read the Bible, because, boy, people are going to be surprised when Christ comes back and say, wait a minute, you're not married to him, you're married to her. Well, wherefore, when I came, was there no man? When I called, there was none to answer. Is my hand shortened at all that I can't redeem? Have I no power to deliver? Behold, at my rebuke I dry up the sea. I make the rivers a wilderness. Their fish stinks because there's no water and dies for thirst. You know, all God has to do is just hold back the rains or cause the air currents to change a little bit. Man, people in New Mexico are really panicky because all of their tourist trade has gone down the drain because they hadn't had any snow this winter. The crazy winds are blowing all the weather down further east before it goes south. So they're just not getting any. Colorado, New Mexico. So I'll tell you, when you read what God says, it's easy for God to just change a little bit, intervene a little bit, and at my rebuke I dry up the sea, I make the rivers a wilderness, their fish stinks. I clothe the heavens with blackness, and I make sackcloth their covering. The eternal God has given me the tongue of the learned, that I should know how to speak a word in season to him that's weary. You know, that reminds me of Christ in the New Testament. He's always saying, I speak what the Father gives me. Of my own self, I don't speak anything. All that I speak, you know, he does that 7 times. It's just accidentally, you know, 7 times exactly. In the Gospel of John, he talks about how he speaks nothing of himself. And this is really talking about that right here. The God the Father gave Christ the tongue of the learned, and he will any of us. You know, the laws are our wisdom in the sight of the world, not our own intellect or our own mentality. The Lord Eternal has given me the tongue of the learned, that I should know how to speak. You know, they looked at the disciples and they said, well, they hadn't been to any of our schools. How can they speak that way? And it says, they took knowledge of them that they had been with Christ. That's all they could account for it. They just must have spent time with somebody that was able. So that's what he's saying here. If you want to have a tongue of the learned that should know how to speak a word in season to someone that's weary, then God's got to give it to you. Get it out of the Bible. He wakens morning by morning. He wakens mine ear to hear as the learned. The Lord Eternal has opened mine ear, and I was not rebellious, neither turned away back. So God won't force his wisdom and instruction on you. You've got to be able and willing to listen. You have to incline your ear. You have to seek wisdom and knowledge. I gave my back to the smiters. So here, more obviously, is talking about Christ. My cheeks to them that pluck off the hair. I hid not my face from shame and spitting. You know, when we used to not believe in beards, we had a hard time explaining that verse, because Christ is talking about how it was with him when he was being crucified, and he said, I gave my cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. Most of us, you'd have a hard time doing that, you know. How are you going to get a hold of any hair there to pluck off any hair off the face? So they must have had beards. I remember the first guy that ever had a beard, we put him out of the church. You can't be in the church and have a beard. That people think you're odd, you know. What are you going to do to the reputation of the church? So, you know, he couldn't let any people have any hair on their face. It's a lot better now, you know. There's a lot more variety, and it covers up a lot of ugly face, you know. Well, we've had to change our explanation on this verse. I gave my back to the smiters. In other words, he didn't resist. He just allowed them to lay those rods and lashes on him. My cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. In other words, people yanking on his beard, which is the worst insult to a Jew, you know. I hid not my face from shame and spitting. He stood right there like a man and took it. You know, he didn't hide his face. For the Lord Eternal will help me. Therefore, I'll not be confounded. So he remembered this Isaiah 50 when he was being harassed and heckled and ridiculed and belittled before the crucifixion. He probably quoted this Isaiah 50 many a time. Wait a minute now. It says, the Lord Eternal will help me. Therefore, I'll not be confounded. Therefore, I have to set my face like a flint. I have to lock my jaw and set my will and not let any of this faze me. He that endures to the end, you know, I know that I'll not be ashamed. He's near that justifies me. Who will contend with me? Let us stand together. Who's mine adversary? Let him come near to me. Behold, the Lord Eternal will help me. Now, you know, you can say this as an individual, as well as Christ said it about God in his time of trouble and agony. Behold, the Lord Eternal will help me. Who is he that'll condemn me? You know, if God doesn't condemn you, then you don't worry about man. Lo, they all shall wax old as a garment. Any humans that would condemn you, they all wax old like a garment. And then they disappear like a garment does. A moth eats up. Boy, that doesn't sound like the wicked burn forever in hell, does it? Like a moth eating a garment up. That's like what happens to the wicked. You know, everywhere you read about the wicked, they disappear. They don't burn forever in hell. Boy, people sure invented a ridiculous doctrine there. Who is among you that fears the Eternal, that obeys the voice of his servant? That's quite a... You wouldn't think you could tell whether you feared the Eternal by whether you obeyed the voice of his servant. Well, yeah, you could. People say, oh, I fear God, but boy, I don't fear any man. Well, that's what happened back in the days of Miriam and Aaron, you know, and God came down and said, Why weren't you afraid to speak against my servant Moses? Well, you may think you have the fear of God, but you better weigh it by verse 10 there. Who is among you that fears the Eternal, that obeys the voice of His servant? Well, God's raised up a servant. In fact, a little later in chapter 51 and verse 2 is one of the examples where God says He chooses one man alone at each time. He says, verse 2, "Look unto Abraham, for I called him alone." Now, that bugs a lot of people. When they read the Scripture that way, that's true, though. You know, God's called Mr. Herbert Armstrong alone. Not going to be any other one. Hadn't been, won't be. And people say, well, who's number two? Or I wonder who the heir apparent is. No, there isn't any. You know, God's called one man alone, and He's going to finish the job. Now, I don't say that when I'm over there, because, you know, the last time Mr. Tkach and some of the men brought that up, when they were over there, he said, he just stopped them right in their tracks and said, now, wait just a minute. You guys telling me God's talked to you, has He? You're going to tell me I can't die, that I'm bound to be here when it's over? Then you don't be telling me that. I don't believe that unless God's told you, and if He has, tell me. Well, you know, they backed off in a hurry then. They just said, well, we think. So, all right, just so I know that's what you think. You're not telling me what God said then, are you? Well, you know, one man preached quite vigorously that he could prove from the Bible Mr. Armstrong wasn't going to die. Well, I think I can too, but I'm not going to be saying that. Especially in Tucson, you know. But, you know, if a man fears the Eternal, he obeys the voice of his servant. So he says, who is among you that walks in darkness and has no light? Let him trust in the name of the Eternal and stay upon his God. Behold, all you that kindle a fire. Now, this is really good humor here. You think God isn't funny, you know. God's saying, you people think you're like God, okay? Let's see you stand in the middle of your fire like I do in mine. That's really what He's saying there, you know. When you see the glory of God, fire going out from around Him, rolling fire clouds encompassing Him. Maybe you ought to read about the presence of God in Ezekiel, as we will later, but here He's literally saying, behold, all you that kindle a fire. Now here He's talking about, we'd call them arsonists in our day. He's talking about people that set fires all the time. That it's an unusual word here used in the Hebrew language. He's literally talking about incendiaries, not the ordinary word for lighting a fire. Deuteronomy 32:22 is the first occurrence, but it's used one other time in Isaiah, and one couple of times in Jeremiah. But here He's talking about people that are fascinated by fire and kindling a fire. Think about the way God is. He's standing there in fire all the time. Fire going out from Him, fire going before Him, fire all around Him. And you want to think you're God, just try that sometime. And you'll go up in flame and you'll find out in a hurry you're not a God. Behold, all you that kindle a fire, that compass yourselves about with sparks, walk in the light of your fire, and in the sparks that you've kindled. That is really, why in the world would that ever be in the Bible? Isn't that an odd verse? Right on the middle of a chapter that seemed to make good sense. And then all of a sudden God just says, light yourselves like fires and see what you come out to be. This shall you have of mine hand, you'll lie down in sorrow. So if you try to set yourself in the middle of a fire, you'll be buried, you know. You'll lie down in sorrow. You'll be dead, you know. But wait till you get to be God and you can do it. Okay, now He says, hearken to me, you that follow after righteousness. So here He's talking about those of us in the church. Because who else is following after righteousness? I'm not talking about Catholics and Baptists and you that seek the Eternal. Look to the rock whence you're hewn and to the hole of the pit. In other words, go back to your roots. Look where you're Christian beginning originated. Look to the rock, the Christ, out of which you're hewn. You're small rocks, hewn out of this huge quarry. So here's a huge quarry with rocks taken out of it, and we're just all these rocks, the whole of the pit, which you're digged. But look back to the rock. Look unto Abraham your father, and unto Sarah that bare you. For I call him alone, and blessed him, and increased him. So there are roots back to God, to Christ, and Abraham. For the Eternal shall comfort Zion. He'll comfort all of her waste places. He'll make her wilderness like Eden, and her desert like the garden of the Eternal. Joy and gladness will be found therein. And boy, all the way through, he puts an end to deserts, so they're not of God or natural. He's going to cause the deserts of Zion to end up like the Garden of the Eternal. Joy and gladness are going to be found therein, thanksgiving and the voice of melody. You know, music is of God, but it has to have melody and harmony, and it can't be morose and conflict and hearken unto me, my people. So the people that follow after righteousness and seek God, they're His people. Give ear to me, O my nation, because a law is going to proceed from me. Well, everywhere you read about God's kingdom, there's no law done away with. There's always a law going out from Zion, the lawgiver. Always a law proceeding. I'll make my judgment to rest for a light of the people. You know, all people need to know is to know God's laws. I was reading in Texas about a man that had been convicted of 5 thefts, sentenced to life in prison because he was a perpetual thief or a habitual thief. Now, you know, if that guy knew God's judgments, each time he stole, he'd be forced to work until he paid back double, or if he got rid of what he stole, he'd have to pay back 4 or 5 times. And if he stole something you can make money with, he'd have to pay back 7 times. Boy, that would be a light for that man, wouldn't it? That would be God's judgment resting for a light of the people. You know, there isn't any justice in man's laws. Can you show me anywhere in the Bible that they locked people in prisons and kept them away from their wife and their kids? You know, a guy has to steal to feed his wife and kids, and they put him in prison where he can't even see his wife and kids. Well, some prisons are beginning to allow visiting from mates. God didn't mean to have humans caged up like animals to keep them away from the rest of us so they couldn't steal our things. Does it do society a lot of good to think, well, we got rid of all those thieves, boy. If we could just catch all thieves and lock them up where they couldn't bother the rest of us good people, and we could just go on enjoying our things while all those other humans made in God's images are in cages like animals, restricted so they don't take our things. Boy, that is ridiculous. That's stupidity. That's not. No wonder God's law is going to make judgment to rest for a light of the people. My righteousness is near. My salvation is gone forth. Mine arm shall judge the people. The coastland shall wait upon me, and on mine arm shall they trust. Now that almost seems for sure he's talking about islands that represent God's people. Because all the way through here, he's talking about people that follow after righteousness, that seek the eternal, that look to Abraham, their father, and Sarah that bear them. God's people that give ear to God. And now he talks about the isles. And he must be talking about England and Australia and their continent, not an island really though. They'll wait upon me, and on mine arm they'll trust. Lift up your eyes to the heavens. Look upon the earth beneath. Because the heavens shall vanish away like smoke. The earth shall wax old. Boy, is that ever true. Air filled with smog and the ground dying and the plants dying and, you know, how can man live a healthy life in an earth that's waxing old like a garment? The ocean's waxing old too. They that dwell therein shall die in like manner, like a garment waxing old. If you've had anything you've worn a long time that's getting thinner and older and more dull looking and more worn out, that's the way we are. We're all dying in like manner, just like garments waxing old. And the worst thing of all, that's the way the earth's doing. God didn't make this earth to last forever, and He didn't make it to hold up under cities of 10 million people in one little radius. Imagine the pressure that puts on the earth down below. We're going to find out one of these days when Southern California just drops off into the ocean. They that dwell therein shall die in like manner, but my salvation shall be forever, and my righteousness shall not be abolished. Hearken to me, you that know righteousness. So he has to be talking about Christians, church people, God's people, the people in whose heart is my law. Boy, that's obvious. That's talking about people that are converted, that have God's Spirit, that are having God's Spirit write His law in our hearts. So this chapter is written directly to us. Hearken to me. We all know righteousness. We're people in whose heart is God's law. So we shouldn't fear the reproach of men. But we do, you know. We shouldn't be afraid of the revilings of men. Boy, you need to read this chapter many times in the future, because how many people end up falling away from the church because they fear the reproach of men? You know, how many forsook Paul? Demas, having loved the present world, forsook Paul, and how many others did? Neither be you afraid of their revilings, for the moth shall eat them up like a garment. So all these reproachers and revilers, they're going to get eaten up like a moth with a garment. The worm shall eat them like wool. There again, look how wicked people perish, not burn forever. But my righteousness shall be forever. My salvation is going to go on from generation to generation, ages and ages forever. Awake! Awake! Put on strength, O arm of the eternal! So here, as if God has just left us and up there and letting things go on and on and on, and finally people want God to intervene, you know. Instead of praying, thy kingdom come, we just say, awake, God, put on your strength. Intervene, do something. Don't just keep sitting up there and letting the earth go the way it is. Well, I'll tell you, being in Houston in a cancer clinic, that's the most pathetic, sickening thing I've had to see in years. I never had such a, you know, see these people coming in there thinking they're getting great help while they're really like robots. Wheeled in wheelchairs, turning ashen gray from this chemotherapy. All the hair gone off them. All their inside just being pickled by all these chemicals. But they're told you can either live 30 days or you can live 11,000 days. If you come in, we may be able to keep you alive that long. But that's all they're doing, being kept alive. You know, why grasp at life if that's all there is to it? You know, going in and being filled with these chemicals or using radiation therapy. Boy, that is horrifying. When I sit there a whole day, I can say, awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the eternal. Help, you know, help God, look at the conditions in the world. Awake, as in the ancient days, eternal, in the generations of old. Aren't you the one that cut Rahab and wounded the dragon, God? Aren't you the one that worked all those miracles in the past and intervened in man's affairs? And awake, God, awake. You ever pray like that to God? You're not afraid to, are you? You know, they did that in the Bible all the time. And God appreciates you doing that. You know, if your kids get excited that way and cry out to you, showing they're really serious, they really mean it, they really need the help, you know, you're a lot more likely to listen. Well, this is Isaiah's chapter about people who have God's Spirit and have God's law in their heart. Aren't you the one that dried the sea? Aren't you, God, the one that dried the waters of the great deep? Aren't you the God that made the depths of the sea a way for the ransom to pass over? Where are all those miracles, God? Remember all those things you did in the past? You're no respecter of persons. You got to hear us, God. You got to intervene. Your name's at stake. You know, look what you said. You said you're the eternal healer. You got to do this. I'll tell you, the first time I ever heard Mr. Armstrong pray that way, I was... Really, that's the first time I ever heard a prayer of faith. Therefore, the redeemed of the eternal shall return and come with singing to Zion. Because they really get concerned about God's kingdom coming, and they see the conditions in the world, and they cry out to God to wake up and get back and help and intervene. And so the redeemed of the eternal return and come with singing to Zion. They come with everlasting joy on their head. They obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and mourning shall flee away. Even I am he that comforts you. So you notice who the comforter is, not the Holy Ghost, not a third member of any Trinity. No, it's the same God that's our Redeemer and our Savior. He's our comforter too. It says that in the New Testament too. Who are you that you should be afraid of a man that shall die? Why, haven't I told you men are like garments that wax old and moths eat them? Then why would you be afraid of a man that'll die? When you're a son of God, who can live forever. Why would you be afraid of the Son of Man that's made like grass that withers and forgets the eternal, your Maker? So, you know, people really have just gotten far away from God if they fear man, if they don't have the reality of God's greatness and God's closeness to them. Forgets the eternal, your Maker, that has stretched forth the heavens, laid the foundations of the earth, had feared continually every day because of the fury of the oppressor, as if he were ready to destroy. Where is the fury of the oppressor? Why, compared to God, and compared to God's power and God's ability and greatness, why, shouldn't be afraid of man at all. The captive exile hastens that he may be loosed, that he should not die in the pit. So here, Israelites that are in captivity, and are they going to still have faith in God and remember God's power and God's deliverance? Well, they hasten to be loosed, to keep from dying in the pit, afraid their bread will be cut off and they won't have any food. But I am the eternal, your God. I am the eternal God that divided the sea, whose waves roared. The eternal of hosts is his name. I've put my words in your mouth. I've covered you in the shadow of mine hand, that I may plant the heavens and lay the foundations of the earth and say to Zion, you're my people. You know, God has to have some people that are scattered into the captivity that remember him in the lands where they're captives. And then God takes those captives and puts his words in their mouths, and they end up witnessing about God's kingdom before it comes. So God can protect you, cover you in the shadow of his hand, so he can restore Zion. Awake, awake, stand up, O Jerusalem. So now God kind of says, you tell me to awake, awake, let me tell you, awake, awake. I'll tell you, God has a real sense of humor. Awake, awake, O Jerusalem, stand up, which have drunk at the hand of the Eternal the cup of his fury. So it's true, they have had a hard, hard time when you look at the history of Jerusalem. They talk about the bloody city. You know, all the nations that came back in the great days of the world empires, their enemy was always on the other side of Jerusalem. So whack, back across they went, and back across they went. And everybody always had to go across there to get to their enemy. You know, nobody ever had an enemy right next door. He always crossed Jerusalem, crossed Palestine. So when God says, the bloody city, he was accurate about it. Drunk at the hand of the Eternal the cup of his fury. You have drunken the dregs of the cup of trembling and wrung them out. And it's kind of like that guy in the fiddler on the roof. He says, what? Fourth, neither is there any that takes her by the hand of all the sons that she has brought up. So you look to any of the 12 tribes, and there are none to help, none to intervene, to spare and deliver, none to guide. These two things are come to you. Who will be sorry for you? Desolation, destruction, the famine, the sword. By whom shall I comfort you? Your sons have fainted. They lie at the head of all the streets as a wild bull in the net. They're full of the fury of the Eternal, the rebuke of your God. So that's kind of a picturesque description of the Jews, like a wild bull, but all of a sudden fainted, lying at the head of the streets as a wild bull in the net. You know, you can't be surrounded by that many million Arabs and continue to get away with it. Sooner or later, it's going to overtake you, and that's going to happen. And that's what's described here. Finally, the sun's fainting, lying dead at the heads of the streets, but like a wild bull in the net, full of the fury of the Eternal. Therefore, hear now this, you afflicted and drunken, but not with wine. You're drunk with all the horrors of the captivity and the punishments.
Thus says your Lord the Eternal and your God that pleads the cause of his people, behold, I've taken out of your hand the cup of trembling, dregs of the cup of my fury. So now God intervenes and delivers them.
You'll no more drink it again. That has to be the last one, you know. How can you say you'll no more drink it again and say that referred back to 604 B.C.? That has to refer to later on in our day, at the final time of punishment of the 12 sons that couldn't do their mother city any good. Finally, when God takes away that cup of trembling, you shall no more drink it again. But I'll put it into the hand of them that afflict you. So they're going to end up with a cup of fury, the seven last plagues, which have said to your soul, bow down, that we may go over. And you've laid your body as the ground and as a street to them that went over. So that may well be talking about the beast power going through Palestine on his way to whip the king of the south. It's described that way very well. And then he goes on as he started off. You know, so many times God lets humans originate, awake, awake, and then he takes that and turns it. Now look at chapter 52. Awake, awake, put on your strength, O Zion. Put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem. I'm not going to call it the holy city anymore. That always bugged me to call a bunch of people on earth a holy city. What's holy about that city? You know, Rome surely isn't a holy city, and neither is Jerusalem. You ever have to go through there, travel there a while, you're going to find wonder why in the world they'd ever call it the Holy City. Well, the Holy City is New Jerusalem. You know, that's what the book of Revelation says. Zion is the city of God's temple, God's mound. That's true. And that's all it's talking about here. Put on your strength, O Zion. Now, if Zion's talking about the church, which Mr. Armstrong said many places, Zion is literally just the temple, you know. That's where the temple was. It's talking about the temple. Well, the church is the temple. So if you're referring to Mount Moriah or Mount Zion, Jerusalem on its north side and all, then you're talking about the church. So is this describing the resurrection of the church into spirit sons of God? Awake! Put on your strength! Put on your beautiful garments! O Jerusalem, the city of the temple, for henceforth there will no more come into you the uncircumcised and the unclean. Well, boy, that can't have been fulfilled. Because there are uncircumcised and unclean all over there, including Jews. Shake yourself from the dust, arise and sit down, O Jerusalem. Loose yourself from the bands of your neck, O captive daughter of Zion. You notice how always the end time, daughter of Zion, daughter of Babylon, daughter of the Chaldeans. That's not the mother, not the old original one, but this is the end time daughter. And this daughter is captive. And yet, the bands of the yoke are going to be loosed from off the neck. And instead of coming down in the dust, like Babylon was told to do, they're going to shake themselves from the dust. They're coming up out of that repentance and penance and humiliation, arising and sitting. For thus says the Eternal, you sold yourselves for naught. You'll be redeemed without money. For thus says the Eternal God, my people went down aforetime into Egypt to sojourn there. The Assyrian oppressed them without cause. Now therefore, what have I here, says the Eternal, that my people is taken away for naught? They that rule over them make them to howl, says the Eternal, and my name continually every day is blasphemed. Boy, you ever hear that all the time, you know? People living wretched lives, people in movies portraying wretched parts, and yet they use God's name all the time, you know. God, you know, they go to church and right along with using God's name and going to church, what are their morals? What are they doing? Anything and everything. Boy, no wonder God says, my name is continually, every day, blasphemed. Therefore, my people shall know my name. Therefore, they shall know in that day. They're not going to know it before, but finally, when they've learned their lesson and they're brought out of it, in that day, they're going to know God's name. And they're not going to be using God's name in their immorality and their wretched lives at the same time using God's name. You know, a lot of times when you hear someone just swearing like a sailor or advocating immorality, you feel like saying, say, what church you belong to anyway? Boy, I never knew a church that you could be a Christian, you know, and live like that. But then they're going to know God's name. How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that brings good tidings. You know, that isn't talking, it's just talking about the means of getting to the place that you distribute the message. How beautiful is the coming of the bringer of good tidings? You know, everybody's feet are ugly. I think feet are the ugliest things on everybody, aren't they? I don't think of any part of humans that are universally as ugly as feet are. So here he's just talking about the beauty of the coming of people bringing the good tidings, that publish peace, that bring good tidings of good, that publish salvation, that say to Zion, your God reigns. How many organizations you find doing that today? Bringing good tidings about the world tomorrow, about God's intervention, about God, about the laws of God, about the truth of God, you know, about Sabbath and holy days and the food laws. And how many are going about bringing good tidings, publishing peace, bringing good tidings of good, publishing salvation, and saying to Zion, telling the church, your God reigns. God is God. He's ruling. Your watchmen shall lift up the voice. With the voice together they'll sing. They'll see eye to eye when the Eternal shall bring again Zion. You know, we'll be able to see God directly, like Moses did, even more so. You can't see eye to eye until you're born again. You know, you can't see a spirit being until you're born of God. So the time is coming when we're going to see eye to eye. That doesn't mean we won't have any disagreements. That means
you can see as you're seen, like Paul said in 1 Corinthians, when the Eternal brings again Zion. Break forth into joy. Sing together, you waste places of Jerusalem, for the Eternal has comforted His people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. You know, we've got a lot of message. We've got to get to those Jews yet. Time, we're going to, and it isn't going to take a whole lot of time once we're in favor with them enough that they'll listen. You know, it doesn't do you any good to be like the guy down here on the square in L.A. shouting doomsday message unless you gain the confidence and respect, and then when you speak, people listen. That's the way it has to be done. Later on, we're going to be telling those Jews all about all this. The Eternal has made bare His holy arm in the eyes of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth are going to see the salvation of our God. Boy, that's great, you know. Chinese people in Fiji and everywhere their eyes are going to admit that God is God. He's made bare His holy arm in the eyes of all the nations. And now He's saying once again to these people who have God's law in their heart, depart you, go out from there, get out from among that Babylonian system. Don't you be a part of it. Don't you participate in it. Boy, that's what we were headed for. You know, it's all birthdays. There's nothing wrong with birthdays. And Valentine, why, who knows that was a Catholic saint. And even if he was, what does that hurt, you know? Show love with hearts and all. And we'd have been doing all that in a matter of time. And God saying all the time, come out of her, don't be a part of her system, touch no unclean thing. You know, that's Mr. Armstrong's attitude. Last time I was over there, he said, I don't want to be wrong in the least little point. Said, people talk about what are the major laws for salvation. Well, who in the world cares about that, you know? You better want to live by every word of God. You know, it's not our job to decide which ones are doctrines of salvation. That's kind of dumb. What does it say in the Bible? Then let's just do it, you know. But boy, people were having that attitude right and left, you know. Oh, well, that's not a salvation issue. Oh, well, that's not a doctrine of salvation. Instead of saying, well, say, would you show me that in the book? Well, if it says that, all right. That wasn't the attitude. God says, depart, depart, go out, touch no unclean thing. Go you out of the midst of her. Be you clean that bear the vessels of the Eternal. You've got to have a certain standard of morality to stay in God's church. He won't let you just live as you please. I've been fairly well shocked, you know. I had 5 years in Big Sandy and a couple of years in West Texas, and I come out here and spend a year and a half, and I can't believe some things people think they ought to be able to do and still be in the church. No, 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 no. You've got to live up to a certain standard of morality or out you go, you know. You can't just do as you please and still be representing the worldwide church of God as a Christian. No, it means what it says here. If you don't depart out of Babylon, you're going to depart out of God's church. He says, touch no unclean thing. Go out of the midst of her. Be you clean that bear the vessels of the Eternal. You'll not go out with haste nor go by flight, for the Eternal is going to go before you. So when Israel ultimately, literally, comes out of the Babylonian captivity, they're going to be supernaturally brought out by God and not fleeing. The God of Israel is going to be your rear guard. I don't know how they ever get that reward in there. That's a real weird one. Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. Now, that really ought to be a part of Isaiah 53. And this is a great chapter to read right while you're sitting there at Passover time. I read this almost every year I can remember, sitting there waiting on the Passover. Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high. Now, when the Jews read that, they thought, well, I didn't say anything about a baby being born in a manger and growing up with parents and being a carpenter, and he can't be the one. And yet the eunuch riding along in the chariot, reading Isaiah 53, he said, say, who's that talking about anyway? And he'd just been up to Jerusalem to worship on a holy day, and he was reading Isaiah 53 and didn't even know who he was talking about. So Philip, by God's Spirit, told him all about it. Now, when you read this, you can see why the Jews would stumble at Christ. Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. He'll be exalted and extolled and be very high. as many were astonished at you. His visage was so marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. Now, you know, for a while, people went through a time period when we used to have a title in Big Sandy, King of Gore. You know, certain preachers at Passover time, they felt you could just be more spiritual if they made a real vivid description of all that gory agony, you know. One guy even went to the place that he got some hamburger meat and brought it out as a part of his sermon, you know, and just showing this old bloody gory hamburger meat. And that's the way Christ was whiplash and beaten. And, well, would that just make you appreciate him that much more when you took Passover? Well, I don't know if any of those guys are still around. Must not make you really appreciate it that much more. And I can't figure out why dwell on making something so gory and so agonizing. I can read it and take it the way it is, and that's far enough for me, you know. Why do you need to magnify that and just blow it up, you know, so people can see all the goriness? Just read as much as God put in there, and, you know, that ought to be enough. All right? His visage was so marred, more than any man. Now, that doesn't mean he was mutilated more than any human that's ever lived. I mean, you've had people blown up with bombs that just were scattered all over everywhere. I don't want any title, King of Gore. I better quit talking like that. Anyway, look what happened. What does that mean, his visage was so marred more than any man? That doesn't mean he was marred more than any human that's ever been killed. His form more than the sons of men. In other words, out of anybody else that was dying there at his time, he was certainly abused more than anybody. No doubt about that. He had more done to him more than any of the others. So shall he startle many nations. He's not going to sprinkle any nations. He's going to wake them up and jolt them and startle many nations. The kings are going to shut their mouths at him. So that's finally going to happen when Christ comes back and they realize, uh-oh, that Jesus really was the Christ. Boy, mouths are going to be shut. Arabs and Jews and all kinds of mouths, all kinds of kings. That which had not been told them, they shall see. That which they had not heard, they shall consider. Well, that doesn't sound like everybody on earth always heard the story before they died, did it? That says some people hadn't been told. Well, I guess Baptists wouldn't like that verse because the way they get it, everybody's already heard the Christ and about the message. And now, after giving that preface about the servant and many being astonished at him and his visage marred and startling nations future when they realize who that Jesus really was, then he goes on saying, well, nobody believes our report. You can go out and shout and yell and preach and people won't believe it. Oh, they believe Jesus was the Christ, no doubt about that. All kinds of Baptists and Protestants and Catholics. But who's believed the report about the whole story? To whom is the Lord's arm revealed? Well, only those of us he calls. Only those he reaches down and enlightens and convicts and reproves. Christ was to grow up before God as a tender plant, as a root out of a dry ground. That shows the condition of the world at the time Christ was born into it. A dry ground, pretty much hopeless and war-filled and desolate. He had no form nor comeliness, so he wouldn't be like a Tony Curtis or a whoever you think is a real handsome brute. He has no form nor comeliness. That isn't what God would want you to admire in the Messiah, not the appearance. So you can't picture him as the most handsome man that ever lived or the most macho man or anything else. He has no form nor comeliness. So it isn't what you'd see by eye that would make you desire him. There isn't any beauty about the physical appearance that would make you desire him. People didn't desire David for a king. They wanted Saul. People thought Saul, the Apostle Paul, was sickly and weakly, and they didn't want him. He's despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows. So a man takes and writes a whole book about a man of sorrows and pictures Christ as a real, morose, sad, despondent, negative man all of his life. And yet the first miracle he ever performs, turning water into wine. And why was Christ at a wedding anyway? Well, that's happy, fun, beautiful, great joy, you know. People ran out of wine. Well, you'd normally think he'd say, well, that's good enough for you. You shouldn't have had any anyway. That isn't what he said, you know. You ought to read the the volume. He either had a mighty big wedding or they had a lot of wine, one of the two. Because he even tells you how many barrels there were. Barrels? Yeah, how many barrels there were. Well, he wasn't a man of sorrows all of his life. He was a man of sorrows because of the lack of men's faith. You know, the little scripture, Jesus wept. We used to memorize that as Baptists, so we'd have a show of knowledge, you know. And that's the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. Now, we never did know why he wept. We always thought he was sad because his friend Lazarus died. That wasn't it. You read the story? He was sad because once Lazarus died, everybody thought that was the end. There was no hope for men. Said, well, if you'd been here, Lord, he wouldn't have died. But now it's too late. Might as well get on out of here. You know, they had no faith at all he could raise the dead. So it says, when Jesus saw their lack of faith, Jesus wept. So when it's a man of sorrows, it's because of man's lack of belief, and it's because of man, not himself. He never had sorrows over himself. He's despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. We hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised. We esteemed him not. Boy, everybody that was there, you know, was kind of embarrassed and ran and hid, and they all scattered and hid behind closed doors, fear they'd get caught. They all hid their faces. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. So humans didn't realize what he was going through when he went through it. The apostles didn't either, you know. They'd say, why, Lord, that's not going to happen to you. You know, Peter did, and Christ rebuked him. But finally we realize it was he did bear our griefs. He bore our pains. He bore our sorrows. He was wounded. It was for our transgressions he was wounded. It was because of our iniquities he was bruised. Notice different words, transgressions and iniquities. And yet one of the men here got chewed out royally for mentioning in the Passover service a couple of years ago down here in the auditorium. He was asked to come up and give the prayer over the bread, and he was so stupid that he asked God to bless that bread that typified his broken body for our healing. And even that sacred night, right after that Passover, he was chewed out vigorously in the basement of the auditorium because he dared degrade such a spiritual thing as salvation into something physical about disease and healing. Well, that's ridiculous. But that's how things got, you know. Some of these men got brainwashed by Protestantism, and it says very plainly here, he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. Two different things. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. With his stripes, we're healed. So he paid the penalty for healing when he was wounded and bruised. That has to do with stripes for healing. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. We've all turned everyone to our own way. And the Eternal laid on him the iniquity of all of us. He was oppressed, afflicted, yet he didn't open his mouth. But boy, we humans, I mean, let us get a little bit of injustice and we really open our mouths. That's really a shame, isn't it, that here our leader could be oppressed and afflicted and yet he didn't even open his mouth. That's an interesting thing to me about the love chapter where it says, seeks not its own. You know, if you've really got love, you don't insist on your rights. You don't insist on saying, now wait a minute, you can't oppress me and afflict me. You can't say things against me. Those aren't justified. You know, love doesn't even seek its own rights. Doesn't insist on its own rights. Doesn't say, now wait a minute, who do you think you are? You can't talk to me that way. I'm important. I'm somebody. Well, our leader was oppressed and afflicted, and he didn't even open his mouth. He was brought like a lamb to the slaughter, like a sheep before shears is dumb, so he didn't open his mouth. And that's kind of like what Paul says. Let every man be swift to hear and slow to speak. You know, God gave you two ears and one mouth. It ought to be kind of obvious what he meant by that. But it isn't, is it? The last enemy every man will control, you know what it is, the tongue. We can steer ships, but look at the tongue, you know. He was taken from prison and from judgment, which means he was unjustly tried. They broke their own laws trying him. At the most, he should have had a fair trial, but he didn't even get justice. He was deprived of his judgment. He was unjustly taken from from a prison. And who will declare his generation? He was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression of my people. So only when they become God's people does his death pay the penalty for their sin. For the transgression of my people was he stricken. He made his grave with the wicked, died there among thieves, with the rich in his death, buried in the rich man's sepulcher. Because he'd done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth, he was innocent. Herod washed his hands of it, said he found no reason for death in him. Yet God had decreed it, so it pleased the Eternal to bruise him. He has put him to grief. When you'll make his soul an offering for sin, boy, how can you do that? A soul's immortal. How can you make it an offering for sin? Well, a soul is not immortal. A soul can die. It has to. Christ's soul was made the offering. That's another good word for immortal soul, another good verse. He shall see his seed. In other words, Christ is going to see sons of God now forever because he is willing to die. He'll prolong his days. He'll get to live forever after being willing to die. The pleasure of the Eternal is going to prosper in his hand. So God's purpose was accomplished by God allowing him to die unjustly and for all of us. He shall see of the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. So when God saw Christ suffer through that pain, then it satisfied God that that could take the place of all of us suffering pain. By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, because he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore I'll divide him a portion with the great. He'll divide the spoil with the strong, because he's poured out his soul unto death. How can you do that? How can you pour out your soul unto death? Well, that's no trouble if you believe the truth. He was numbered with the transgressors. He bare the sin of many. Not all? No, not unless they repent and become his. He bare the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors.
Okay, we're ready for chapter 54. Here again is another one of the admonitions to shout out in a victory song. It's a little bit subdued in the King James translation, but literally in the Hebrew it says, shout in triumph. Same terminology as back in chapter 52 we read a little earlier. Break forth into joy, sing together, you waste places of Jerusalem. The watchmen shall lift up the voice, with the voice together shall they break forth into singing, for they'll see eye to eye when the Eternal brings again Zion. Literally, being spirit, so we can see God as he is, as Paul says back in 1 Corinthians. Something similar to this is quoted back in Zephaniah chapter 3, a parallel. Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 14. Here again it just says, sing, O daughter of Zion, shout, O Israel. And really it means more than just sing, it means shout out in triumph, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O Israel. Be glad and rejoice with all the heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. So it's a Feast of Tabernacles type atmosphere of celebration over victory, like the victory song of Moses. And here he looks down on the city of Jerusalem when it's been barren. In other words, all the people are gone. They're in a captivity. So he talks about Israel being barren. Of course, it's quoted in Galatians with reference to Sarah. You might notice that in Galatians 4 and verse 27. Here again, another book that's used by the Protestants to do away with the Old Testament, and yet it quotes out of it more than most other books except the book of Romans. Galatians 4, verse 27. Here he's been talking about this analogy. Abraham had two sons, one by a bondmaid, the other by a free woman. The one of the bondwoman was born after the flesh, but of the free woman was born by promise. So he's likening the spiritual to the physical. They're an allegory, the two covenants. One from Mount Sinai that brought the people into bondage because they didn't have the spirit to live by it. Agar, Mount Sinai in Arabia, like the Jews that weren't called in that day. The Jerusalem of that day in bondage with their children. The Jerusalem of the future is the spiritual Jerusalem. It's like the church, the mother of us all. It's written, "Rejoice, you barren that bears not, bring forth and cry, you that travails not, for the desolate has many more children than she which has an husband." And so Paul takes that out of this context in Isaiah and parallels it with the covenants. So it applies to Sarah as well as a barren Jerusalem. Break forth into singing. Cry aloud, you that did not travail with child. So here he's talking about how all these captive sons are going to come back to Jerusalem, and they're going to be repopulated. In fact, the Jerusalem of the future is going to have more children than it ever did in the past. So if you can see both the physical and the analogy that's used here, Paul paralleling it with Sarah and Hagar and the covenants, and yet in another way it's talking about the depopulated Jerusalem and the return later of the children. More are the children of the desolate than the children of the married. As when you were here originally, married to God, later you're going to have more children when you come back out of that barrenness and desolation than you've ever had before, says the Eternal. Then he goes on, enlarge the place of your tent. In other words, you're going to spread out. You've got to make room for the increased population that's going to be there in the millennium. Let them stretch forth the curtains of your habitations. In other words, the other cities and areas of Judea are going to continue to spread out. Lengthen your cords, strengthen your stakes. Bigger and bigger tents, larger and larger spread out tents. For you shall break forth on the right hand and on the left, and your seed shall inherit the heathen and make the desolate cities to be inhabited. So it's talking about the spreading out of Israel during the millennium and ruling over the Gentiles to start off with. Don't be afraid. You'll not be ashamed. Neither be you confounded. You'll not be put to shame. You'll forget the shame of your youth. So here God looks back when they were idolatrous and when they were in bondage in Egypt and all the heathen practices they followed. But later on, there's going to be no reason for fear, as they have today, surrounded by all those millions of Arabs. But he says, in the future, when you're spreading out, you won't need to be afraid. And there'll never again be any being ashamed or being confounded, because you'll not be put to shame. You'll forget the shame of your youth. You'll not remember the reproach of your widowhood. Of course, when God put them away for their harlotry with other gods and other nations, they went into the captivity. They were widowed. God left them without a husband. For your maker is your husband. And uniquely, the word maker here is a plural word. So it ties right in with Genesis, where God said, "Let us make man in our image." So the Hebrew word maker there is plural. It doesn't mean a trinity, but it means there has to be more than one. Your maker is your husband. So that shows the very God that Israel was married to was the same God that did the creating. The Eternal of Hosts is his name. That's one of the titles of God that's 281 times in the Bible. So if you thought you read it a lot, you did. 281 times. And the fact that it says the Eternal of Hosts just literally means he's the over the host of heaven and the host of man on the earth. He's the maker of all men, all beings. And your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. So here are a number of titles of God. You know, a lot of times in your prayers you may use a lot of these titles for God. That I remember in a spokesman's club one time in one church area, the topics master asked for all the titles of God people could think of. And they rattled off our high tower, you know, all of the shield and buckler. And, of course, here your maker, your redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, the Eternal of Hosts, the God of the whole earth, shall he be called. So that shows, again, that's still future when he's the universal God. For the Eternal has called you as a woman forsaken and grieved in spirit. and a wife of youth when you were refused. So now he's showing how God took her originally when she was young and entered into a marriage with her, and then later God put her away and forsook her, and she became widowed without a husband, and her ex-husband literally died, and that's how she could be widowed. And yet he's going to call her back again as a woman forsaken and grieved in spirit. For a small moment I have forsaken you, but with great mercies I'll gather you. In a little wrath, and it doesn't necessarily mean in size or volume, it just means a spontaneous, a burst of original wrath. I hid my face from you for a moment. Now, of course, at the time Christ was bearing the sins of the world, God hid his face from Christ as well, and that's why Christ cried out as he did, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? But for that very instant when he was a sin bearer, God had to turn his face away. So he likens the same thing here to this woman that he was married to. I hid my face from you for a moment, but with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on you, says the Eternal, your Redeemer. For this is as the waters of Noah unto me. For as I have sworn that the waters of Noah should no more go over the earth, so have I sworn that I would not be wroth with you nor rebuke you. And interesting enough, you'd say, well, I wonder how many times the name Noah would be used in the Bible. Well, the fact that he was there at the flood and the one that delivered people through the flood, you'd probably expect it to be a combination of a number of judgments, a number of 10. And so it is. The name is 42 times in the Old Testament and 8 times in the New Testament. So the word Noah is in your Bible 50 times, which is, of course, a multiple of 10, the number of judgment. But here God likens his covenant with Noah, that even though the waters destroyed the earth for sin at that one occasion, that it never would be that way again. And so God is saying the same thing about Israel, as he's going to put them away because of their sin, then no more will he enter into the punishment with them. So have I sworn that I would not be wroth with you nor rebuke you. For the mountains shall depart and the hills be removed, but my kindness shall not depart from you, neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed. Now, most people, when they talk about the old covenant, they never want to think of redemption, forgiveness, grace, peace, and yet that covenant was a covenant of glory. There was a glory of that covenant. So you notice that as you read through the Old Testament, it always brings that back to your mind. The mountains shall depart, the hills be removed, but my kindness shall not depart from you, neither shall the covenant of my peace be removed, says the Eternal that has mercy on you. Then he comes back, looking at her when she's afflicted and desolate and barren again. Oh, you afflicted, tossed with tempest, not comforted. And right away it makes you think of Hosea, where God's no longer going to have mercy or comfort his people. And so here he's looking at them in their captivity. Behold, I'll lay your stones with fair colors and lay your foundations with sapphires. I'll make your windows of agates and your gates of carbuncles and all your borders of pleasant stones. Now, all of us will have to get over the tendency by then to talk about extravagance, because God's fairly extravagant, you know. When you read about the New Jerusalem, that's really extravagance. It's hard to imagine a city 2,500 miles square, east and west and vertical. And you think about all those rare stones, and right through the Bible, God brags about where man used iron, he'll use brass, and where man used brass, he'll use silver, and where man used something else, he'll use gold. So God is a multi-trillion, billion, jillionaire, so I'm going to make your windows of agates, your gates of carbuncles, all your borders of pleasant stones, and all your children shall be taught of the Eternal. And this literally is a Hebrew terminology, literally meaning disciples of the Eternal, or the Lord. same word again in chapter 50, back in verse 4. All your children shall be disciples, and great shall be the peace of your children. So they'll be under that covenant of peace. In righteousness, you'll be established. Of course, there are plenty of proverbs showing that when the leaders are righteous, the nation's established. When the people are righteous, there's peace and stability and strength. So that goes right with this scripture. In righteousness, you'll be established. You'll be far from oppression. You'll not fear, and from terror, it won't come near you. Behold, they'll surely gather together, but not by me. So here he's talking about nations that are going to gather together against Israel, but they're not like Cyrus, or they're not like Darius or Nebuchadnezzar that God brought against them. So some of the nations that turn against Israel in the future can't use the excuse, well, God used us, God brought us there, and God wanted us to punish you. And so here he says, behold, these enemies of yours are surely going to gather together, but it's not by me. Whoever is going to gather together against you is going to fall for your sake. So God is going to have to bring down those powers that fight against Israel for his sake, for their sake. Behold, I've created the smith that blows the coals in the fire, that brings forth an instrument for his work. So God is saying, why should you fear powers always invading and conquering and taking you captive and desolating you? Only when I allow it can it happen, because I've created the smith that blows the coals in the fire, that brings forth all these weapons. Really, the word instrument there is the same word as the word weapon in verse 17. And why they're not consistent in translating, who can say? So here God says, look, I make everything, the man that does the metal work, the rocks that they use, I make all of that. I've created the waster to destroy. No weapon that's formed against you shall prosper. Every tongue that shall rise against you in judgment, you'll condemn. So that's the future. That's what's the way it's going to be in the millennium. No weapon is going to be allowed to be used. No person's going to be allowed to make these weapons of destructiveness. Any tongue that rises against God's people to suggest any punishment is going to be judged. Notice how he summarizes in the last part of the verse. This is the heritage of the servants of the eternal. So that's talking about all of us. When we're born as God's sons, that's our heritage. We're going to be able to deal with any would-be enemy this way. And there's going to be the covenant of peace, and there's going to be no more barrenness, desolation. There's going to be no more captivity and anguish and suffering. This is the heritage of the servants of the eternal, and their righteousness is of me. So your righteousness isn't self-righteousness. You know, you're only righteous if you're righteous by God's laws, because all of God's commandments are righteousness. And we go beyond God, and we establish righteousness that is beyond the Scriptures. So when we're in possession of our heritage, our righteousness is of God, says the Eternal.